The date is November 25th, 1987, and we're watching Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Oh my! Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past that nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me is my podcast partner,
Colin Stewart.
And this week, it's not Thanksgiving for us. We are Canadian, so we celebrate Thanksgiving in the middle of October. So we are celebrating American Thanksgiving with this American Thanksgiving movie. And so we brought in another guest. We love having guests on this show. And so this week we welcome Carly Holm. Carly, welcome.
Yay! Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited to have you. I know when I threw out some suggestions of movies to have you on the show with, you took one look at Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and went, John Hughes. I love John Hughes. Sign me up for that one. So what is it with John Hughes? What is it with this movie? Is there, you know, what's the connection?
I mean, I was really excited because I actually had never seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles before.
Really?
I had heard of it.
Okay.
And I think he was one of those ones where I was at the age where I was really into John Hughes movies that I wasn't quite old enough to watch that one, especially with like the certain scene where there's get me a fucking car and blah, blah, blah. So yeah. I think there was just part of that my parents were like, maybe you can wait a little bit till you see this one.
Or watch it edited on TV because they still put that scene in the edited movies, but they do. I don't know whether they did an alternate take because they just cut out a lot of the fucks. And you don't see his mouth moving. So I have a feeling they might have done like two versions of that scene so that
yeah.
they could have a PG-rated version.
Yeah, they often do that.
This movie is also a departure from what I'd call the classic John Hughes
oh, definitely.
Of The Breakfast Club. I actually didn't even know it was directed by John Hughes
yeah.
until I finished it.
Yeah, there was definitely some stylistic things that I caught in there, just like some of the cinematography or even just the soundtrack that it's like, yes, this is very John Hughes, but even like the whole... I guess some of the aspects of the story of just like friendship and two
yeah.
people kind of two different worlds of people coming together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's
yeah.
like them making friends in the Breakfast Club. Yeah. It's the,
yeah,
the people
yeah.
that don't belong together.
And that's one of my favorite movies is The Breakfast Club. So it was like, as soon as I saw John Hughes, I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. this is up my alley. I'm excited for this.
Well, and I was just about to ask you here. So, I mean, obviously Planes, Trains, and Automobiles has taken the number one spot at this point, but up until this point, what is your favorite John Hughes? Is it Breakfast Club?
I would have to say probably Breakfast Club. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is very high up
yeah.
there as well. That was like a movie that I was almost like conditioned to like
mm-hmm.
as a child. Like me and my mom watched that movie, like Ferris Bueller, all the time. Like that was kind of a childhood staple, but one that I really latched onto was The Breakfast Club. But like
yeah.
we had those like movie trios of like The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, and Weird Science. So it's like I grew up and those were like a really big part of my childhood, even though I was a little bit too young for them when they actually came out.
Yeah.
A little bit too young. I wasn't even born yet. but they were still a really important part of my childhood and growing up. So
yeah.
I was like, hey, John Hughes, that's something that I can definitely relate to.
I know that when I worked at video stores when I was younger, I mean, I worked at Blockbuster Video, but I also worked at like a local independent video chain as well. So Blockbuster, they always had the trailer reels that would play on the TVs all day long, but at the independent video store we were allowed to choose what we wanted to watch, and I know Ferris Bueller was one of those ones that it was almost a daily occurrence that Ferris Bueller would go in because it was a movie we just wouldn't get tired of. And it was appropriate to play before 8 p.m. It was only after 8 p.m. that you could get away with playing the mature rated movies or something like that. So, okay, this week we're looking back at November 1987, when the movies in theaters were Ruskies, The Running Man, Teen Wolf 2, Three Men and a Baby, and of course, our movie for today, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which earned $49.5 million on a $15 million budget.
And of course, please remember this movie is about to be 33 years old, but currently only 32 years old, but still very old. So There will be spoilers ahead, so please, if you don't want the movie to be spoiled, stop right now, go watch it, then come back and hear what we have to say.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is a very fourth wall breaking one. Steve Martin had no reason to panic until John Candy came along. You know, it's an okay one.
Why don't they use their character names?
Well, I did find a second one, however, and I think this one's pretty good. What he really wanted was to spend Thanksgiving with his family. What he got was 3 days with the turkey.
I like that one.
But that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Alrighty. 60-second synopsis. Neil Page is an executive stuck on a business trip just days before Thanksgiving, business trip to New York, longing to get back home to his family in time to celebrate the holidays. Unfortunately for Neil, the universe, armed with not-good-natured lawyers, a snowstorm, and the dastardly Kevin Bacon as its weapons, is conspiring against him. Enter good-natured doofus Del Griffith, a traveling shower curtain ring salesman, which is a job that is way too specific, with a positive attitude and no social graces. Neil reluctantly joins forces with Dell in his quest to get from Wichita to Chicago, riding, you guessed it, planes, trains, and automobiles, before his wife runs headlong into the throes of depression. Seriously, could this woman look any sadder? That is your 60-second synopsis.
Nice. Yeah, you know, while you were reading that, I was thinking maybe the reason they didn't use the character names is because they were banking on the fact that Steve Martin and John Candy mm-hmm. were going to be the biggest draw for this movie. I mean, John Hughes on his own is probably a pretty good draw, but I think, like Carly kind of mentioned in the beginning, that this is such a different kind of John Hughes movie. I wouldn't be surprised if, okay, no, we're going to bank on the fact that we've got these two incredible comedians in this movie. I've read that the original plan for this movie was that it was going to be a vampire movie. The idea was that, yeah, that Del would have been a vampire trying to get Neil to invite him into his house. So as intriguing as that idea is, I'm so glad that it never happened, because
yeah.
I love this movie. I've always loved this movie. And I must say, I definitely got more out of this viewing even. It's still a great movie to me.
I mean, that's a good premise for a sequel.
Yeah.
I mean, it could pick up right where the last time, you know, it could have. John Candy's obviously no longer with us, but
yeah.
Just gone full horror.
So we already found out that Carly has never seen this movie. What about you, Colin? What's your experience with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
I watched this movie for the first time within the last 5 years, for okay. sure. So I didn't have a big history with it before then, and I'd probably only seen it that one time before this, but I really liked it then, and I really liked it now. Like I said before, I didn't realize that it was a John Hughes film, but I love John Hughes too, so yeah. It was all good.
Alrighty, well, let's jump into Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, directed by John Hughes, and clearly, I found out, I'm not very familiar with John Hughes and who he truly is. I mean, I'm familiar with, like, his amazing catalog, but like, I was stunned to realize how few movies he's actually directed. He only has 8 directing credits, which are 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, She's Having a Baby, Uncle Buck, and Curly Sue, and this one. But he is a writer, mm-hmm. and that's where he has 52 credits, one of them on this movie, and all the ones I just mentioned, plus movies like Vacation, the Home Alone movies, Beetlejuice, no, not Beethoven, Mr. Mom, and Flubber. And he also has 23 credits as a producer, also this movie, and many of the ones I just mentioned. However, for this movie, he isn't the executive producer. That honor goes to Michael Chinich, who has only 8 producer credits, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He has more credits as a casting director. We open this movie with no music, which is such a fantastic way to open a movie. There's no credits, there's no music, it's just sound effects of planes, trains, and automobiles, And as the title comes up on the screen, it scrolls across the screen with each applicable sound accompanying each word. And we are told in an establishing shot of a skyscraper that we're in New York City 2 days before Thanksgiving.
I thought that the way the title comes across the screen was not how I typically see a comedy movie open.
Yeah.
It seemed a lot like, I felt like it had an action movie feeling.
it does remind me a lot of Die Hard.
Yeah.
Die Hard has a very similar credit opening. The very first thing we see after this establishing shot is a close-up of a watch, specifically a Piaget Polo 8673, and it's the earliest I've ever done this, but let's go to Sponsorship Corner! So, I want to start by saying that I tried Googling this specific watch, but I couldn't find it. However, other Piaget watches in the Polo series, because they've got a whole Polo series of these watches, they range in price, and the cheapest I found was $10,086.75.
Holy.
The most expensive, $310,665.11. That's a pretty hefty price tag. Like, unlike Dell's Casio, I couldn't find a Casio over $150. So this is another huge one, though, for Sponsorship Corner and product placements, which really makes up for Willow last week, where I had to make up a credit for that one or a sponsor for that one. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is brought to you by Piaget and Casio Watches, Ibis Cosmetics, USA Today, Roy Rogers Restaurant, Federal Express. It should be noted that that's what the van said. They didn't change their brand to FedEx until 1994. Mayflower Moving, Bacardi Rum and Miller Lite Beer, Time, Forbes, GQ, Newsweek, and Us Weekly Magazines, American West, U.S. Airways, Transworld, and American Airlines, which, interestingly, since this movie came out, they are all owned by American Airlines. All of those other companies went bankrupt and were either bought out or merged with American Airlines. Cracker Jacks, Chiclets Gum, Kent Cigarettes, Diners Club Credit Card, 9X Telephone, Namco and Atari, specifically the video games Galaga and Centipede, respectively. Jockey Shorts, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, Doritos, Pontiac, Lincoln, and Datsun Cars. And in their crazy taxi ride, there are Garfield and Rolling Stones air fresheners. And also this movie is a little unique. And it was really tough to figure out the sponsors for this movie because there are several fictional brands, mostly because of the fact that no transportation companies wanted to lend their name to a movie that shows employee incompetence or equipment failure. So the fake companies are Mid-Central Air, Contrac, which is a name created by blending Amtrak and Conrail, Trans-Missouri Bus Lines, Marathon Car Rental Company, Chalmers Big and Tall Man Shop, and the semi they ride in at the end is for the fake Oshkenagan Cheese Company. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. That's a big one. And yeah, it was a nightmare to research because every time I wrote down something, like especially when it came to some of these plane companies and everything, I put a question mark in my notes. So I was busy on the Google machine for a lot of this. So where was I? Oh yeah, the first fucking scene. Okay, so the watch belongs to Neil Page, the eternally white-haired banjo enthusiast Steve Martin, from The Jerk, Three Amigos, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, Father of the Bride, 1, 2, and 3-ish, which was a quarantine short film, which was a special fictional reunion in aid of the charity World Central Kitchen on September 25th on Netflix and Facebook and YouTube. Neil is impatiently waiting while his boss, or is he a boss, or is he a client?
I thought it was a client.
Well, okay, so he works in Chicago, and I mean, this is a time before teleconferencing. So yeah, he works in Chicago, or lives in Chicago, and like this is obviously a business trip, so I figure he's a client.
Yeah.
I thought just from the way that they were discussing like the covers of, or like the pictures, that it seemed more like, yeah, like it was a client being like, well, I like this one better, I like this one. Whereas I feel like a boss would probably just be like, is this what it needs to look like? I don't know. Yeah. It felt a little bit of like a, or like, I don't want to be rude and I have to leave, so I'm just going to stay, versus like, if I leave, I'm going to get like my ass kicked by my boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. I've changed my position.
So this client is trying to choose between three different advertising mock-ups. Neil is panicking because the guy is taking forever to choose, and he has a 6 p.m. flight to catch, which we see when he pulls out his plane ticket to double-check the time. I don't know why he's double-checking, but I like that John Hughes is nice enough to highlight the time for us on the plane ticket.
Spoon feed you.
I will say I love this scene. The silence that they use in this scene, instead of just worrying about joke after joke after joke, like the whole feeling of the scene and the silence that... You know, the most that you hear is when he whispers, I got to go.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a brilliant scene. Great directing.
Steve Martin, too, just with, like, he's such a... almost reminds me of Jim Carrey with, like, just his facial comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, he uses a lot of his face to really highlight funny moments. And I mean, it comes up later in the movie and stuff as well. But just the amount that he's able to portray without using any words is super impressive.
Yeah.
And it kind of just lends itself so well. It makes it funny without, like looking or fishing for jokes or making that punchline, or, you know, not spoon feeding us all of the jokes like he does in the ticket, but, you know, it uses that comedy to his advantage.
Yeah. So after all the waiting, the guy can't decide anyway. So now Neil is worried he'll miss his flight and didn't even close the deal. His partner, John, a cameo by Lyman Ward, who was the dad from Ferris Bueller, tells him that he should just take the 8 p.m. like him. But Neil has promised his wife he'd be home by 9. He forgot to grab his gloves, but has to go. So he asked John to grab them and he'll pick them up tomorrow at his house. Spoiler alert, he just jinxed himself. As the elevator closes, John says, you'll never make the 6 o'clock. Down on the street, Neil is trying to hail a cab, something that's nearly impossible during rush hour in New York. Around the corner on a less busy street, he spots an on-duty cab at the same time as a man across the street. That character is called Taxi Racer, played by Kevin Bacon. I love the directing here. Like, the fact that they narrow their eyes with each other across the street. And it's a very Ferris Bueller thing. Like you had mentioned in the beginning, there are some John Hughes tropes. John Hughesian moments. And this is definitely one of them, the narrowing of the eyes. But they race down the respective sidewalks toward their target. Neil pulls ahead, but as they get in the vicinity of the cab, Neil trips over a trunk and falls into the street, almost getting run over. And Kevin Bacon wins the cab. Dejected and making note of the trunk that foiled him, Neil sees another businessman about to get in a cab and attempts to bribe him into giving the cab to him. He offers $10. Is that a lot in 1987? But then $20, and the guy comes back with, I'll do it for $50. Neil agrees and is told anyone willing to pay $50 will certainly pay $75. But this guy is a lawyer, so of course he's a thief. While this negotiation is happening, someone has taken the cab, so now Neil is out $75 and one cab. He chases it down the street, catches up long enough to throw open the door to see Del Griffith, Canadian legend John Candy from SCTV, Splash, Spaceballs, Uncle Buck, Cool Runnings, The Great Outdoors. Neil yells at him to get out of the cab, but the cab speeds off. I'd like to note that his briefcase gets run over by two different cars, but in later scenes... perfectly fine.
It's an incredibly durable briefcase.
they made them solid back then.
Yeah. Somehow, after all this struggle, he still manages to get to the airport on time, just to find out the flight has been delayed anyway. He calls home to tell his wife, Susan Page, who is played by Layla Robins, who incidentally is 14 years younger than Steve Martin. This was only her second screen credit after a movie called A Walk on the Moon. She's in An Innocent Man, which was a Tom Selleck movie, Homeland, and now the Amazon series The Boys, which is a series that I fucking love.
Mm-hmm. Who is she?
She's the FBI agent, the one that's taking over for the one that dies.
Oh, she is too.
She's in the second season of The Boys.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I guess
I'll just have to go watch it all. Well, again.
And the funny thing is, I watched this movie and I still had like two episodes left of the second season.
Yeah.
And so then I went back and watched it and I'm like, holy shit, yeah, that's her. She doesn't look very good anymore, but, you know. So we also see his son, Neil Jr., who is played by a very young Matthew Lawrence, brother of Blossom's Joey Lawrence. Whoa. Neil is still optimistic he'll be home by 10. As he sits and waits, he ends up sitting across from Dell, who is absorbed in his smut novel called The Canadian Mounted. Not a real book, by the way. I did look it up. But hilariously, this book also gets read by Deadpool in Deadpool 2 when he's in the X-Men mansion. He's got his feet up on the coffee table and he's reading The Canadian Mounted in that. So,
do you think that's like an homage to John Candy being Canadian?
Absolutely. 100%. And from something that I read, John Hughes is also a fan of many things Canadian. So it was something that I think was, it was honoring both of them.
It was a choice, yeah.
The Canadian Mounted.
I wanted to read that book. Like, I was
we should theorize as to what the possible plot might be.
I don't think you have to theorize very long.
All you gotta use is like the actual title page, and you can pretty much, you get the whole story.
Pretty much, yeah. So he recognizes Dell from the cab, and I love the directorial choice here to put a cab door in front of him when he recognizes him. A great introduction scene because of the fact that Dell recognizes him too, but doesn't know why. Neil, who is definitely a bit of an asshole, tells him he stole his cab. Dell denies it, but then admits how unusually easy it was to get a cab during rush hour, and ends up feeling bad about the misunderstanding. He offers to buy him a drink and a hot dog to apologize, but Neil just isn't having any of that shit. The plane is finally being boarded, and there's been a mix-up with seating assignments. Neil's first-class ticket has been swapped for coach, and he's definitely a bit of a snob. Like, at this point, I'm thinking, just accept it. At least you're going home.
Yeah.
And it's only a 2.5 hour flight. I looked it up. It's only a 2.5 hour flight. But Neil finally admits defeat against the flight attendant he's arguing with and finds his coach seat. And of course, it's right next to Dell. So Dell properly introduces himself and he's a shower curtain ring salesman. What a job. Like, I like in your synopsis there where you said it's almost a little bit too specific of a job.
It's way too specific. And honestly, until I watched this movie, I never realized there was so many different types of shower curtain rings. I thought there was just like a standard plastic loop.
Yeah, and there's that kind that is filled with helium, so it's lighter. In his pitch later on. So Dell is the chatty type, but Neil just wants to be left alone. Other than being the chatty guy, Dell becomes the most obnoxious seatmate ever by also taking off his shoes and socks and waving the sock around. But, you know, I get it. Those dogs were barking.
That, like, people who take their... I understand taking your shoes off. Like, I'm the type of person when I get on an airplane, like, my feet swell. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take my shoes off. Taking your socks off. Maniac. That is a maniac. That's like, get this person away from me, because who wants their bare feet? Oh, that just, I saw that and I was like,
that guy's a straight up sociopath.
Yeah. I'm like, hear what happens to him now. He took his socks off on the plane.
So even though it's only a 2.5 hour flight, the lights get turned off and people are sleeping. Have I just not been on enough short flights at night? Like, is this normal? Like, all my flights in recent memory have been 6 hours or longer. And that's when they dim the cabin lights.
I mean, sure. I can't remember
the last time I've been on a short flight at night.
Yeah.
I went from Vancouver to Edmonton, which is, again, an only, like, an hour-long flight. Mm-hmm. And it was at night. And they dimmed the lights. I think I fell asleep.
Okay. Well,
so I think, I don't know.
I just thought maybe it was just one of those things that's bizarre. Like, the travel distances in this movie definitely don't make a lot of sense, because I googled a lot of them and there's no way that this journey should have taken this long. It's almost like he could have walked to Chicago in the time that he spent trying to get home every other way. So while everyone's sleeping, Neil is still awake with Del sleeping on his left shoulder and the old man on his right. And as he's looking at Del, Del opens his eyes and says, $6, am I right, nut? Say we aren't landing in Chicago. And he's right. This snowstorm is too heavy in Chicago, and they are rerouted to Wichita, Kansas. So we get more great fast-talking salesman-y type lines from Del. We have as much chance of getting out of here tonight as playing pickup sticks with our butt cheeks, or you'll have as much chance of finding a hotel room as finding a three-legged ballerina. God, John Candy is just so funny. So we get the hilariously dry Ben Stiller, who is the Bueller teacher, and I also used to watch him on a...
Ben Stein.
I said Ben Stiller. Holy shit. the hilariously dry Ben Stein, who is the Bueller teacher. I also used to watch him on a game show game show called Win Ben Stein's Money.
I love that show.
I especially loved on that show when if you answered it like a Jeopardy question, you had to wear the dunce cap. So he gets a cameo here to officially announce that all flights are canceled. Well, while Neil was phoning home again, Del was phoning around for hotel rooms and managed to use one of his many, that guy owes me a favor because I sold him shower curtain rings connections, to secure one. He offers to use his connections to get Neil one too, in exchange for paying for the cab ride. Looking at what a bleak option sleeping at the airport is, he accepts the offer. They get into a ridiculous cab driven by Doobie, who is played by Larry Hankin, who has 188 credits, Breaking Bad, Friends. He was Carl in Billy Madison, the landlord in Pretty Woman, Kokolovich in Armed and Dangerous with John Candy, and he's taking them on the scenic route. You know, I have noticed that this movie is pretty much a two-person cast and a whole bunch of bit parts.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of how this movie is, because no one makes a reappearance in this movie except for the wife that they keep flashing back to. Mm-hmm. But like even her, she's just a glorified cameo. They get to the seedy looking motel and Del greets his old customer with more smarmy salesman lines like, still $1 million shy of being a millionaire. They're going to get the last room in the joint, which they begrudgingly accept and decide to split the bill. And the desk manager takes imprints of their diner's club cards and accidentally mixes them up, returning them to their respective owners. A very emphasized and important detail for later. This is almost like highlighting the time on the plane ticket.
Yeah.
So they get to their room and find only one bed. I love the comedy here combined with the music, that like music that they've got going on, because they just keep trying to act casual, but they always keep glancing back at the bed. And then Del asks if they should shower, which adds an extra moment of discomfort before clarifying that he meant no, separately. And so Del goes first. After he's done showering, while Neil is in the shower, Del is hanging out on the vibrating bed. I've always wanted to try one of those, but like 42 years old, I have yet to find the opportunity to. I've never seen one of these vibrating beds in person.
I didn't even know those were a thing.
Yeah, I don't even know that they exist anymore.
I doubt they do anymore, but I'm sure they were a thing. It's kind of like how back in the 80s you could find water beds everywhere. Yeah,
I
was going to say,
I would have thought water beds would have been the thing
in
this movie.
So after chuckling at the shower curtain rings, Neil is having the shower from hell with water cutting out. He gets soap in his eyes, then it comes out super hot. And at the end of it, he looks out and there's this great editing of looking around at the mess in the bathroom that Del has left. He's used all the towels. But here's the real question. Why is the state of the bathroom a surprise? Because presumably Neil had to walk through all this filth to get into the shower. But Del has been on the vibrating bed. He didn't come in while he was showering.
Maybe he likes to enter the shower blindfolded.
Just closed his eyes.
I do also, however, love the physical comedy of the washcloth being the only option for drying off, though, with him trying to wipe his back like it's a full-size towel.
I mean, we've all had that experience, I feel like.
where I've looked at the t-shirt that I just took off because there's nothing else in the bathroom.
Well, this is what it is.
Yeah, when you're at like a friend's house and you take a shower, but you forget to check ahead of time if there's a towel, and then you're like, oh.
Yeah, I have to accept it. This is about
shake yourself off a little bit.
Shake yourself like a dog and then rip off some toilet paper and pat yourself dry. It's bedtime and Neil is trying to get comfortable on his side of the bed, even though he's sleeping in a puddle of beer that exploded when the vibrating bed shook it up. Bell proves to be even more obnoxious as a bedmate than he was as a seatmate on the plane with his bedtime routine. He's trying to read his book by lighter, which is a funny moment, cracking all his joints and clearing his sinuses.
The scene was so aggravating to me. It'd be similar to Carly when you saw him take his socks off on the plane, but this scene, I don't know, I was just like angry at Dell. I could feel the annoyance in my body watching him crack his neck and then start clearing his sinuses and just like
yeah, that got me too.
Yeah, and I wonder if John Candy did a first take and then John Hughes is like, nah, amp that shit up, man. Like, get those sinuses clear. Like, we need more sinus. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, snoring, I remember back in the day when I was wrestling in university and we'd go on these out-of-town trips, and I mean, like, the guys that I'd room with, I've never been a bad snorer, but there's guys I room with who were, like, literal chainsaws.
Yeah.
And it was the worst. And yeah, so watching that scene, I was just...
Well, I feel like, as well, like, this is one thing, but if they were to remake this movie, I feel like it would all be like, it would be like a sleep apnea machine.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's how they would update this movie. And I have read that there is a remake of this movie coming.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it's starring Will Smith and Kevin Hart.
Oh no.
Well, now I will say this much. Last week with Willow, I called Willow aggressively white, but it's got nothing on this movie. Holy shit. I did not see a single non-Caucasian face in this movie at all. And especially when you consider what I said earlier about it basically being a series of cameos. There was a cab driver. There was a cop. There were the ticket agent. There were all these opportunities to throw in any diversity and none whatsoever.
Yeah. I was kind of disappointed at the cab. Well, I mean, I guess they want to work together, but if they were going to have a Kevin Hart, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I just love Kevin Hart and The Rock together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would have preferred that.
Well, see, and Kevin Hart, I do like a lot of his movies, but I do find him annoying after a while. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my bigger draw for this movie would be Will Smith.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just
don't think either of them, both of them to me seem like the Steve Martin character.
Yeah,
neither of them seems capable of being John Candy.
Well, mm-hmm. But you know Kevin Hart will be.
Yeah, he's going to be. But there's like there's better comedians, I think, to play that role.
And I don't understand why they have to make it a remake.
Yeah,
right, like pair those two together and make a movie that is basically Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But why do you have to call it Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yeah.
I mean, they've kind of done that. Like, I don't know if you've seen it's called Due Date with Zach Galifianakis Robert Downey Jr. That movie is like, it's very much a blatant copy almost of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Yeah.
Unable to take it any longer with all this sinus clearing and everything, Neil springs out of bed and starts to get dressed to leave, and really being an asshole, letting Dell have it in an insulting monologue. This scene, though, has such great performances. Because, like, I mean, Steve Martin is just going on his rant, and his is a little bit over the top, but it's still such a great rant. But then Dell comes back and, like, he just gets you in the feels.
Oh, yeah.
Like, John Candy's rebuttal is just so heartfelt. And I love this monologue. And I've always loved the character choice or the writing choice of not having Dell fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's still just a very timid character in a way. like for all his obnoxious and brashness of being a salesman, he is still also a very timid character and kind-hearted. And I've always loved this scene and the juxtaposition of the two of them. And it works. He makes Neil feel like an ass.
I think there's also another really cool, it's almost, I don't know if it's meta juxtaposition or it's something that I am the only one that caught on to this, but I really love this almost like panic of being like, oh my God, well, we have to sleep in the same bed. And like, oh my God, like, I don't want to share a bed with this man. But then they are also fighting like couples do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I thought of that. And like almost instantly, it was just like, this is kind of some beautiful irony that either the writing, either John Hughes thought up, or maybe it was improvised, that it kind of just melded together this beautiful kind of dramatic irony of them being so scared of being like, and again, maybe it's that like late 80s, almost like gay panic of like, well, I don't want to seem like I'm, no, this is not what I'm insinuating, but then also they're fighting like they're a couple.
Well, and it's very true. I do actually have comments like that in my notes coming up about the relationship status of these two. And I definitely noticed that as well. But yeah, at this point, Neil feels like an ass. Neil doesn't leave. And so he crawls back into bed. While they're sleeping, a burglar breaks into their room using a switchblade. I will say, it's my youthful memories of this movie that make me extra cautious in a motel room. Have you ever stayed in a hotel or motel and not used the chain on the door?
I don't think I've ever used it.
Oh, really? Okay. Because I'm thinking, I don't have a chain on my door at home, but anytime I stay in a hotel, why not?
Yeah, we have a chain on our door at home, and it's always on. Like, especially if I'm at home alone, like even during the day, if I'm at home by myself, that chain's on the door.
Yeah. The burglar takes all the cash out of their wallets. Next morning, we get a great edit where we get Patsy Cline's back in baby's arms. Such a beautiful song for this moment. And we find the two of them tenderly spooning in bed. Del is the big spoon and he kisses Neil on the ear. And they groggily wake up and slowly come to the reality of their situation. Why did you just kiss me? Why are you holding my hand? Where's your other hand? Between two pillows. Those aren't pillows.
Best.
Like, so much story is told with just five lines, right? Like, so they leap out of bed trying to shake it off and change the subject to sports. So kind of what you were alluding to there with this homophobia of the 80s. Neil goes to wash his face in the bathroom, and maybe you're right. Maybe he does enter bathrooms without looking at his surroundings, because he starts splashing water on his face and he turns on the water and he finds that Del's socks are soaking in the sink and he's been washing with sock water. So, okay. So first, let me ask, he turned on that tap and it was running for about 3 seconds. How does it not occur to him that the sink is full already? But yeah, second is, how did he not see this the night before when he got out of the shower? Like, did Del get up in the middle of the night to wash his socks?
But also, why? Like, well, I guess I assume Del must have, like, an extra pair of socks.
Yeah, because I don't even understand the idea of him soaking them overnight in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything, he should have washed them and hung them to dry.
Yeah. His underwear.
because now he's going to be packing or even wearing wet socks. So they have breakfast and the plan is now to take a train. And I appreciate that the modes of transportation are in order of the title. Like, it would be like calling a triathlon a swim, bike, and run. Neil goes to pay for the meal and he finds no money in his wallet. He accuses Del of taking the over $700 he was carrying. Like, I know this is back when people carried cash, but how long was he in New York that he needed $700 in cash?
That is a lot. Like, I mean, I don't know if I've ever had just $700 in my wallet, unless I was on my way to, like, maybe back in the day when I had to pay my rent with cash.
Yeah.
But that's crazy.
Yeah,
in New York of all places, you get mugged.
Yeah, exactly.
I would just be like nervous the entire time. If I had that amount of money in my wallet, I'd be freaking out the entire time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so Del pulls out his own wallet and says, count it. I have 263. A penny more and you can accuse me. And Del's wallet is also empty. So they realize they were robbed. They need a ride to the train station, and Dell has secured a ride with the son of one of his many connections. And while they wait, they discuss that they'll charge their way home. What kind of plastic do you carry? Neil has a Visa and a gasoline card, and a Neiman Marcus card if they feel like buying someone a gift. And Dell has a card for Chalmers Big and Tall Man Shop, 7 chains in the Pacific Northwest. Great stuff, but no good here. But notice how neither of them actually mention their Diners Club's cards, yeah, which we've actually seen.
What is a Diners Club's card?
It was one of those failed credit cards from the 80s.
I was going to say, is it like a given? Does everybody just have a Diner's Club card?
The way it kind of seemed when they were talking about like what type of plastic they had, it was almost like at this time you got credit cards for specific locations, almost like gift cards.
Yeah. No, Diner's Club, it's kind of like if credit cards were a totem pole, Visa is the little bird at the top, and Diner's Club is like the little troll thing that's holding up the whole totem pole.
Is that why back in the day they'd always, like, you always had to pay with like a major credit card?
Yeah, it's like Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and then way down there, probably even below this Chalmers Big and Tall Man Shop, is the Diner's Club card. It was around, I think, pretty much just for the 80s. So their ride arrives, and this is Owen, who is played by Dylan Baker, who has 139 credits, and I know him best as Dr. Connors in Spider-Man 2 and 3. Owen is a hillbilly with one of the best performances. Like, Owen, I thought, was like the funniest outside of our two heroes. I thought he was the funniest. Like, the train don't run out of Wichita unless you're a hog or a cattle. Like, people train run out of Stubville. And then he's talking to his wife, get your lazy ass out of that truck and grab their bags. She's tougher than she looks. Second baby come out sideways and she didn't even scream or nothing. With John Candy's reaction of, what a trooper. So they get a ride in the back of the truck. Neil almost gets gloves, but almost gets eaten by a dog at the same time. What do you suppose the temperature is? One. Like, another great line. But as a Canadian in the 80s, when I first saw this movie, I mean, you know, I was only like 10 years old. I didn't know that Fahrenheit existed. So when he says one, I'm like, that's warm.
Summertime.
You're a hoser, John Candy. You should be able to handle one. Neil buys the tickets for the train, but he couldn't get two together. He gives it to Dell as a gift, probably just because he doesn't want to give Dell his phone number or address. They say goodbye, and Neil gets if this was a relationship movie, this is the tearful goodbye. Neil gets a bit of a nap in, but ultimately the train, of course, breaks down. Everyone is forced to get off the train, and reluctantly, Neil partners up with Dell again. Dell buys them bus tickets, but could only get them as far as St. Louis. So on the bus, we meet the characters Bus Lover and Bus Loverette when Neil gets busted watching them making out. I checked their IMDb. These are the only credits for the two people making out on the bus. Dell kind of becomes king of the bus. These are his kind of people, it seems. And he's leading sing-alongs like the Flintstones theme. I wonder if I should mention the Flintstones as part of Sponsorship Corner. At the bus station, Dell manages to scam a bunch of different people by selling his shower curtain rings to people as jewelry, while Neil tries calling home again, but his family is at his daughter's Thanksgiving pageant. Growing up in school, I remember, like, two pageants that you would do a year. You'd have like the Christmas concert.
I feel like we only had the Christmas concert.
Yeah, see, I was thinking maybe a spring concert, but yeah, come to think of it, I think it's only the Christmas concert. So, like, Thanksgiving pageant?
Well, it is big in America, I feel like.
Yeah. I was gonna say, like, school plays or performances are so much like bigger over there. Yeah, they have Thanksgiving. You know, you watch like any like typical American show where they have kids in school and there's like a Thanksgiving pageant and a Christmas pageant. President's Day. Yeah. Elections, like student body elections. There's a pageant. Like, it seems like there's pageants for everything.
Yeah. Dell and Neil go for lunch. So if the motel room was a lover's spat scene, this is now their breakup scene. Neil has told him that when they put their heads together, they've just really gotten nowhere. And Dell insists that Neil take half the money at least, But yeah, I love the, it's a breakup without like being an actual breakup, but like all the emotions of a real breakup scene are there. Neil has arranged a car rental. He's dropped off by the Marathon bus in the rental lot, and he discovers that his car isn't there. It's like the only empty spot, too. the entire car rental lot is full except for the one spot. He freaks out, and he can't chase down the Marathon bus and has to walk a great and treacherous distance to the car rental counter at the airport with the "You're Messing with the Wrong Guy" song playing. Here we meet the rental agent, who is the magnificent Edie McClurg, who is yet another Ferris Bueller alum, who is busy on a personal call. She gets off the phone at the sight of him, and we get my favorite scene, and the only reason this movie isn't rated PG. Now, any regular listeners will notice that our show contains profanity, and although there isn't a whole bunch, I am aware that like 90% of that comes from me. Basically, I don't think Colin swears enough. So partly for my own cheap thrill.
I have to break out my monologue work.
Yeah, that's right. I've decided to do something here that neither Colin nor Carly are aware of. So I've just sent both of you a message on your phone here. Okay, so open those up. Because we can't legally play a clip of the scene, and I know both of these friends from the theater world, I thought we could do a little live performance in a segment I like to call "I Used to Like This One Piece Theater." Okay, so Carly, you are going to be the Edie McClurg character, and Colin, you are going to be Neil Page.
I'll do it in her voice too. I'll try and do it.
If you can do that wicked Wisconsin accent, you got it. Yeah. Okay. Here you go.
Okay. Welcome to Marathon. May I help you?
Yes.
How may I help you?
You can start by wiping that fucking dumbass smile off your rosy fucking cheeks. Then you can give me a fucking automobile, a fucking Datsun, a fucking Toyota, a fucking Mustang, a fucking Buick, 4 fucking wheels and a seat.
I really don't care for the way you're speaking to me.
And I really don't care for the way your company left me in the middle of fucking nowhere with fucking keys to a fucking car that isn't fucking there. And I really didn't care to fucking walk down a fucking highway and across a fucking runway to get back here to have you smile at my fucking face. I want a fucking car right now!
May I see your rental agreement?
I threw it away.
Oh boy.
Oh boy, what?
You're fucked.
Yes!
End scene.
I used to like End this scene. One Piece Theater.
I have also never heard Colin swear before, so that was scary being on the other end of that. Seeing as also the show we did, I was never in a scene with Colin before.
Yes, and in that show, he was pretty intimidating. And yeah, so dejected because he's shit out of luck for a rental car, he goes to the taxi stand out front and attempts to hire a cab to take him from St. Louis to Chicago. 297 miles, by the way, and current fares for a St. Louis taxi are $2 a mile. So in today's rates, it would have been a $600 cab ride if he could have convinced them. I suppose in the sequel, Uber will probably make an appearance. Reboot.
Reboot.
Yeah. Like, the only way this remake is going to work is if at some point they both drop their phones in a tub of water or something.
Yeah. Like, are they going to update the technology, or is this something like, that's the weird thing about remakes too. It's like, are you going to remake it when it's in that time, or is it going to be, you know, in the future, like in the present? Because that's super confusing for people.
And you're doing it without John Hughes now, which is
disappointing.
But, you know, again, going back to the whole diversity issue, I realized that a lot of John Hughes movies, I don't think there's like black characters in any of them, especially in the leads. So it'll be refreshing, but it's just up in the air for me right now.
Could they even, like, I'm just thinking, we don't even have Greyhound buses anymore.
Yeah.
No.
So we can have that part. Like, do we have, like, is there a bus line?
Right now we've got some sort of, like, interprovincial bus that...
Oh, is there?
Yeah. Okay. So, the taxi guy jokes that a plane would be faster and he would get a meal. The flight is 1:15, by the way. You would not get a meal. Neil snaps back with, if I wanted to joke, I'd follow you into the bathroom and watch you take a leak. This gets him punched in the face by the taxi dispatcher. He falls onto the road and once again almost gets run over by another car. This one is driven by Dell. The taxi guy is pissed at Dell and yelling at him to move his car. Dell says, I'll move the car, but you have to help this man up. My pleasure, says the taxi guy as he grabs Neil by the crotch. Now it's automobile time in this movie, and Dell is driving a tricked out 1983 Chrysler LeBaron, but I've noticed they've taken all the Chrysler insignias off of this car. Neil is in the passenger seat looking miserable as Dell muses that he's never seen a man picked up by his testicles before. We get a couple more nut jokes, and Neil is responding in what sounds like a helium-fueled voice. I always thought this part was funny. There's been a passage of time, and now Neil is driving while Dell fiddles with the electric passenger seat. So much movement for this seat. Like, I love the physical comedy from John Candy, but it's definitely super unrealistic with the distance that he moves. They get into another minor argument with each other, Dell saying that he doesn't complain about Neil's faults, which all he can come up with is that Neil fidgets with his nuts a lot. Neil says, you know what I want? And Dell says, I don't know, a couple more balls and an extra set of fingers? Hey! I fucking love John Candy. So, we get another passage of time. Even though the drive between St. Louis and Chicago is less than 5 hours... So, like, on road trips, I don't think I've ever given up after less than 5 hours to get someone to take over driving for me. But now Dell is driving again while Neil complains that the passenger seat is broken. Neil chooses to grab a little nap and he puts his wallet in the glove box. Don't let me forget it's in there. While Neil sleeps, Dell is smoking and dancing along to Ray Charles's Mess Around. I can't hear this song without thinking of this scene. Like, anytime this comes up in my shuffle on my phone, I always see John Candy playing the piano on the dashboard with the smoke hanging out of his mouth. So he throws his smoke out the window, but it blows back into the back seat. And after a while, Dell starts to get hot, so he tries to take off his jacket, but ends up getting the sleeves caught on the control levers. I find it interesting that the driver's seat has manual controls instead of power ones like the other seat. Like, that's what he's hooked his sleeve on, his manual controls. So did cars back then not give power seats to the driver, or is this just a big fuck up on the film's part?
I don't know. I've been in cars where one seat has power and one seat has manual, but I kind of feel like it was the opposite
it's
way
usually
around.
The driver that has it, yeah. He's now driving with his knees. Hit the brakes, dummy! But he takes his eyes off the road for a few seconds while he tries to free himself and ends up exiting the road. There's a stop sign and he slams on his brakes now, spins out, starts screaming, and Neil wakes up casually, asks if everything is okay, and suggests that Dell takes off his coat because it's getting hot in here. Good idea. They get moving again, but Dell is all turned around and ends up going the wrong way on the highway, and a car traveling on the other side of the highway, traveling in the same direction and the correct direction, honk at him and try to get their attention. And Dell concludes they're drunk. Neil wakes up again to the commotion and rolls down his window to hear what they're yelling. You're going the wrong way! How does he know where we're going? He's drunk! Thank you! But at this moment, Neil realizes what they've meant. Just as two semi-trucks come over a crest, they narrowly avoid dying as they drive right between the trucks, scraping the shit out of the side of their own car. I love, again, it's the directorial choices. Like, I kind of wish John Hughes had directed more movies because, like, some of his choices are great. So this whole bit where they're driving between the two cars and, like, he sees Dell as a skeleton at one point and then he sees Dell as the devil laughing at him. Like, I just absolutely love these little moments that they put in. After the trucks finish driving by, they slam on their brakes, spin out again, but this time all of Dell's luggage, which was tied to the trunk, goes flying into the road. Why wouldn't he have put the trunk in the trunk? Like, and if it didn't fit in the trunk, at the very least, why not the back seat?
Yeah.
Why did he go to the trouble of tying this to the trunk of the car?
I don't know. I swear there's other scenes where they put the trunk in the trunk of a car, but it's like they don't even bother. Like, I'm pretty sure when he puts his trunk in the taxi at the beginning of the movie,
yeah,
he puts a suitcase on top of it and they just drive away.
Yeah.
Like, without it being locked down. Maybe the trunk just belongs in the trunk.
I guess so. I did read that there is actually a longer cut of this movie. Like, the original cut was over 2 hours long. And one thing that happened is they actually overshot Chicago after leaving Wichita, and they had to backtrack. So, like, that explains why there's so many weird inconsistencies with the amount of time it takes to travel.
Yeah.
But, you know, it definitely shows you there were things that were definitely left out of this movie. So, freaked out, Neil's fingers are stuck in the dashboard, and Del has bent the steering wheel, but you'll notice that steering wheel is perfectly circle in later scenes. They collect Del's luggage off the road and sit down on Del's trunk with their back to the car to take a breather, but behind them, the cigarette that flew back in the window earlier has set the car ablaze. And they notice it, and this gets Neil laughing his balls off, imagining the reaction from the rental place when Del returns the car. But then it dawns on him, how did Del rent a car anyway? Not believing the excuse of slipping the rental agent a couple sets of shower curtain rings, Del comes clean. He had Neil's credit card in his wallet. He was gonna give it back, but Neil hadn't given him his address or phone number. Neil demands the card back, but it turns out that Del slipped it back into Neil's wallet when they gassed up. The wallet that's now in the glove compartment. He punches Del in the gut, something in the next scene that he comments about. You could kill a guy slugging him in the gut like that, I'm prepared. That's how Houdini died, which is a true fact. I looked it up. Houdini died after getting hit in the stomach and complications for some ruptured something, internal something. Yeah. Somehow the car is still drivable, which is impressive. I love that the car is still drivable. Like, you know, the Tommy Boy car doesn't go through nearly as many growing pains as this car does throughout the course of the movie. But they find a motel. The clerk at the front desk won't take his melted credit cards. This time he mentions the Diners Club card. The room is $42.50. Neil counters with, how about $17 and a hell of a nice watch, which is why I made note of the values of these watches earlier, because did he just hand over $30,000 to this guy? And he says, please, I've been wearing the same underwear for 3 days. And Del says, I can vouch for that. And this is one of those things where I think that it might have been something that was cut out of earlier scenes, because he says 3 days, but really he's been wearing his underwear for like 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is their second night together. So he hasn't been wearing that underwear for 3 days, unless he only packed one pair of underwear to New York and has been there since Monday. So,
in that case, gross.
Yeah. He should have taken that off in the plane and started waving it in Del's face. That's. But the clerk accepts the offer and Neil gets a room. He gives no offer to Del to join him, so Del has to try to negotiate as well. He has $2 and a Casio, which he displays like a spokesmodel. No deal. Del is left to sleep in the car with no roof in the snow. Unable to make a phone call home because of lock on the rotary dial. Rotary lock. There's a product that has become obsolete. And this is why they'd have to drop their cell phones in water in a remake. He decides to take pity on Del and invite him to sleep in there. He does have two beds after all. They actually start to get along as they drink together and talk. These snacks and little liquor bottles, they must have been in Del's trunk, right?
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I'm like, where do these come from?
Yeah, they didn't go to a vending machine if all they had was $2 between them.
I was wondering if they were like hotel, like little hotel.
Like a mini liquor, bar? But does this seem like the kind of...
But it would also cost them money that they don't have.
Yeah.
Well... they end up crashing through the wall of the motel yeah, too. I guess honesty isn't something they'd be concerned about, but it doesn't seem like the kind of hotel that's fancy enough to have a minibar. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's like 10 empty Doritos bags on the bed. Also, the trunk, it's almost its own character in this movie, but we never do see it open, do we?
No.
So that must have been where all these snacks were. That's all Dell's carrying around is snacks.
That's where the body is.
That's why it's so heavy.
Marie is in the trunk. Oh, no. There's the vampire sequel.
That's like his coffin he sleeps in.
The next morning, the car is snowed into its spot. Neil is doing a piss poor job of pushing it out. However, as a Canadian who has pushed out many a car out of snow, his strategy is all wrong. You gotta get behind that car. And why didn't John Candy step up and tell John Hughes this wasn't accurate? Like, come on, John Hughes, he's gonna get behind that car. Yeah. But they decide to rock it out. Dell does a reverse first and ends up crashing through the wall of the motel, and they take off. So now they're criminals. Advantage to pain and cash, I guess. Their journey continues, and now they're buddies driving down the highway, singing in their open top burnout of a car, huddled up in winter gear. They go past a cop car who clocks them doing 78 miles per hour, and he pulls them over. And the cop is played by Michael McKean. One of the Spinal Tap guys. He was in Clue. He was in Short Circuit 2. He played Perry White on Smallville. He asks what they're driving. Oh, we had a small fire last night. Caught it in the nick of time. Great line from John Candy. And then the even better one. Do you know how fast you were going? Funnily enough, I was just saying to my friend here that the gauges are all melted. Radio still works, though. It's the damnedest thing. Clear as a bell. But the car gets impounded. And so once again, they're stranded without a mode of transportation. Dell secures a ride with a truck driver, and as he climbs out of the cab, he tells Neil the driver is skittish about people riding up front. So is this true? Or is the driver actually skittish, or has Dell already just talked his ear off enough to make the trucker say, fuck that, I'll drive him, but I don't want to deal with him.
I think it's
that sounds about right.
The latter?
Yeah, it's probably the fact that Dell has this way of intimidating people. So they ride the rest of the way to Chicago in the back of a refrigerated cheese truck, but they finally made it.
How many days have they been on the road at this point?
This is their third day.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the movie.
So this is now Thursday. This is now Thanksgiving Day.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought for some reason I thought maybe I'm wrong, but I thought the beginning of the movie said that it was 2 days before.
Two days before Thanksgiving, yeah.
Oh, so yeah, it's including that day. Okay, yeah. Get it.
Yeah. So they're finally dropped off at the subway station. Well, I don't know if Chicago's are actually subways, but I didn't want to say train station because I thought it's not the same kind of train as they took before. So if this was a romantic comedy, this is the teary goodbye scene. Neil gets on the train, and as he rides, we get a fantasy montage of what Thanksgiving will be like at the Page household. His mind wanders to his time with Dell, and suddenly he has an epiphany thinking of some of the clues Dell has given. Holy shit, Dell is homeless, he realizes. He goes back to the subway station and finds Dell just sitting. His wife Marie has been dead 8 years. Neil invites him to come home. This is sloth all over again, man.
if this is a romantic comedy, the scene of them both holding the trunk walking down the street,
yeah,
that's like the makeout sesh.
Yeah. that's the big welcome back kiss. Absolutely. Dell meets the family that welcome Neil home, and finally ending with Neil's wife, who is oddly formal with Dell. Like, he says, Mrs. Page. She says, Mr. Griffith.
Like, this scene, the more I think about it, it reminds me so much of the ending of Home Alone when Kevin he's just in the living room and his mom comes in and he, like, plays all coy or whatever, mm-hmm. all shy. That's exactly what the wife is doing in this situation where she's, like, looking down and then she kind of looks up and then gives the, like, little smile. Oh, it's okay. I was mad, but... Yeah. We're fine now.
No, I definitely got that vibe too. It was very like Home Alone.
Yeah.
Like this big family reunion.
Yeah, and like what you said in the very beginning where it's, yeah, this is a very John Hughes trope. So there we go. The end credits. Oh, snap! But wait, there's more! We get a post-credits scene in the same way Ferris Bueller tells everyone to go home at the end of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Did either of you get to the very end of the credits?
I can't see.
No, it. Amazon cut me off.
Oh, shit, you're missing out.
I watched on Amazon, too.
So the post-credits scene, it goes back to the executive from the opening scene. And he's still trying to pick the right ad.
Well,
beside him on the conference table, there's a turkey dinner. I never knew this scene existed before now. But doing this show, I have gotten into the habit of letting the credits run when I watch a movie. Because sometimes there's some hints for my notes that I can pick up in the credits. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I waited till the end. Because I was even getting to the end and I'm like, well, Ferris Bueller did a post-credits scene, so... maybe, and sure enough, boom, post-credit scene, and it was, the payoff was amazing. Nice. that credit, the executive still looking at the ads, like it was hilarious. And there you go, that is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Now, Colin, Carly, on IMDb, it scored a 7.6 out of 10 and had a Metascore of 72. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 91% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 87%. But as always, those are just numbers. What did people have to say about this movie, Colin?
All right, so I'm going to go to Rotten Tomatoes for this week's critics. Like Sean said, everything was like glowingly positive. So most of them all say the same thing. You know, it's a great Thanksgiving movie, great holiday movie, one of the best movies John Hughes ever made. Steve Martin, John Candy, incredible, blah, blah. But probably my favorite review from Dennis Schwartz at Dennis Schwartz Movie Reviews is just one sentence. It's the perfect film to see on an airplane. Which, I don't know. I mean, next time I'm on a plane, maybe I'll test it out. I was trying to think. I thought about it so much that first I was like, oh, that's a really good, like, positive critique. But then... the more I think about it, the more I think it might just be a sick burn. I don't know. It could go either way.
Is it like some sort of like curse, like seeing the Scottish play in a theater? If you watch Plane, Trains, and Automobiles on a plane, you're instantly, your flight's going to get canceled. They're going to land the plane. You're not going to be able to go home.
Well, see, but by that logic, what's it like if you watch snakes on a plane while you're on a plane?
You're just in trouble.
That seems like a worse omen.
Yeah, so that's all I got for critics this week. There wasn't any. I really tried to find like a 1-star review or somebody who hated this movie, but it's impossible. You can't hate this movie; it's too good.
Yeah. Right on. Okay, so yeah, IMDb going harder on this than Rotten Tomatoes. Mid-70s for IMDb and like 90 for. I'm surprised that 91% is from the critics and not the audience. Like, yeah, that's impressive.
Rare. That's very rare.
Yeah. Okay. Carly, your first watch of this movie, where does it fall for you?
I really liked it. I find nowadays, especially because there's so many things on the go, that if I turn on a movie, I'm instantly like trying to do something else or like multitask while I do it. And I even told my fiance, I was like, well, I'm going to put the movie on and I'm going to like fold some laundry and like put some laundry away while I watch it. And I instantly... like, as soon as I put it on, it was so easy to watch that I sat down and I watched the entire thing. I didn't look at my phone. Like, I didn't do anything. It's so easy and so entertaining to watch that, you know, I really like it. It's up there with one of the better movies that I've seen in a long time. Yeah. Which is funny because it is like an older movie, but,
it's 33 years old.
Yeah. But it's just, it's entertaining. I think it is fun for a huge age demographic, especially with like the physical comedy. I'm a big sucker for that, especially in theater and in movies and stuff like that, being able to use your physical body as well to tell a story. And I think this does an absolutely fabulous job of doing that. Again, I don't think it needs to be said, but John Hughes just knocks it out of the ballpark with almost everything that he does, and I don't think this is any exception. I think it was absolutely fabulous.
And like with your comment about the physical comedy, we talked about this a bit in our UHF episode, where it's just like, you know, there were these fantastic elements to the movie that just, it took you out of the reality of it. And so in this movie, there are a few of those moments, like when he pulls his fingers out of the dashboard, you know, things like that. There are a few of those, but none of the physical comedy goes too far to take you out of the realism of this relationship. And at its core, it really is a romantic comedy in a way. Yeah. You know, and that's something that I definitely was impressed with, is you have these great physical moments, but the only one that I think would have been completely unbelievable if you had actually witnessed it would have been him getting picked up by his testicles. If you had actually witnessed it beyond the initial grab, if you had seen him actually haul him to his feet by his crotch, that might have been harder to believe. But
yeah.
So Colin, what about you? Where you seem like you still love this movie as well.
Yeah, I'd side with the critics on this one for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, just watching this movie, anytime I see a movie that has John Candy, I leave it feeling like I need to watch more movies with John Candy.
Right?
He is just...
Holy shit, yes!
He is just so good, and there's, like, Home Alone, Uncle Buck, like, these are movies from my childhood that he's in that I've seen, like, numerous times, and Canadian Bacon, but
I love Canadian Bacon.
But actually haven't, like, gone out and watched, like, his broader catalog, so that's something that I think I might do. And even Steve Martin too, he's also very good. I haven't seen a lot of his movies either, but yeah, I don't know. And I think this movie too was, like you mentioned in the scene with Dell, where after Neil yells at him and he comes back, it's just, I always think of John Candy as a comedic guy, but he's actually just a very good actor.
Yeah, like that part where I like me.
Yeah,
you know, my wife likes me.
Yeah,
like it just it's like, oh my god. Like,
yeah, that
tearing
is hard.
My fucking heart out right now. Like, yeah, he definitely has his moments. And like, Cool Runnings, there's a few moments like that as well where, yeah. You know.
Yeah, so that was kind of my takeaway. I think I want to, since no new movies are coming out really anytime soon, maybe I'll spend the rest of 2020 just infusing more John Candy into my life.
Oh, and I totally know what you mean. Like, you know, I feel like after watching this, yeah, I could have been like, okay, Colin, our next four movies are Armed and Dangerous, Delirious, you know, and Wagons East, you know, like the ones that I don't know as well. Like Uncle Buck, I know really well, and The Great Outdoors, I know really well, and even Armed and Dangerous to an extent, but it has been many years since I've seen that. But yeah, like Wagons East, I can't remember the last time I saw Wagons East, and I just think, oh yeah, I should go watch some John Candy. If you add that to the rest of your 2020, though, don't forget Hot to Trot, which is a Bobcat Goldthwait movie where John Candy is the voice of a talking horse.
Oh,
it's kind of like an updated Mr. Ed in a way. So yeah, I have to agree with you. This is, except for the complete lack of diversity, which all these 80s movies, we've become so accustomed to seeing how whitewashed they are, and it's unfortunate. But with that aside, my God, like there's nothing that is completely tasteless. There's nothing that is wrong with this movie in that sense, in the sense of like being offensive or not holding up to this day. So I still love this movie. It still made me laugh hard, and
it's kind of like a time capsule. Like there's nothing that doesn't hold up, but it was interesting to see like the rotary phone lock,
yeah,
and things like that, which is again why I can't imagine what a remake would look like. But
yeah.
Well,
there we go. That is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and that's our show for this week. Oh, big thank you for this American Thanksgiving celebration from three Canadians. Thank you to our guest, woo-hoo, Carly Holm.
Thank you, Carly.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I mean, on top of wanting to see more John Candy movies, I feel like I need to go back and watch a couple extra John Hughes movies as well. You've gotten me excited about a couple of the ones that you mentioned where it's like, oh yeah, Ferris Bueller. It's been a while.
Oh yeah. I'm definitely going to be watching Ferris Bueller tonight.
If you like that show, one thing you can do is to really help us out on the business end is to go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars if you have that option on that app. It doesn't really matter what you say. You could say, I like me. Yeah. Give us some feels in your review. But
you
it's
also
not
say I like that one.
I like that one. It's not for our egos though. I promise you that. It's just for business. It helps drive us up the charts and helps us get noticed.
And if you want to get in touch with us, a good way to do it is by email. I used to like this one, all one word, @gmail.com. Also check out our website, iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our social media, find links to our podcast catalog, listen to all our previous episodes. And social media is the best place to look if you want to find out what we're watching so that you can watch it as well and then come enjoy the ride.
And Patreon, if you want to be a producer of the show, if you want to do more than share, more than word of mouth with your friends, and you want to support us financially, go to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we get into the Christmas season. When we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One. Oh,